Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to Cinefix. Once again, I am not Clint Gage, but I am Alex Deadman, and we're doing another episode of the Cinefix Not 100. You heard right. Not on our top 100, but we are talking about a movie today, and I'm joined by another familiar face, my ATF agent, Michael Calabro. How you doing?
Good. I thought we were going to smuggle $500,000
out
of the Cabo.
I actually went back and forth about if I was going to do like, you know, gun smuggler or ATF agent.
Yeah.
We're talking about a movie that is on only your list, Cal, but not anybody else's. Tell us what it is.
We're talking about Jackie Brown.
That's right.
The third junior picture, I guess, from Quentin Tarantino. You know, I think this is probably his most like under the radar movie, and I'm really excited to talk about it. Like,
I wouldn't disagree. I mean, I think Death Proof is up there. But I gotta say, I'm surprised as this as a pick for you. Yes, it's a crime movie, which we all know Cal is a sucker for, but it's longer than I know you like movies to be. Is this like the only Tarantino on your list? I'm curious.
No, it's not the only Tarantino on my list.
Is it your favorite Tarantino?
No, it's not that one either. No.
Yeah.
I mean, I won't spoil it. Like, I still rep Pulp Fiction. I don't.
That makes me think we're going to talk Pulp Fiction pretty soon because it's up there for me.
I think that's like a lot of people's like gateway to movies. That particular movie, it's like that first time where like I saw it as a teenager and it's like it clicks where it's like, oh, movies are kind of like art as opposed to entertainment.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, anyway. Pulp Fiction's real high, like is real high on my list. I very much love that movie. This would have been a movie I saw shortly afterwards, because like when you talk about like a young like budding cinephile who's like trying to like consume all of Tarantino and stuff like that, you may start with either Reservoir Dogs or you start with Pulp Fiction, but you watch both of those one after the other. Whatever one you've seen first, like you see the other one next, and. I saw this movie for the first time like when I was going on my initial Quentin Tarantino kick when I was like in high school. So that would have put me as like a sophomore in high school. That would have been around 2002. So this would have been the only movies available, because I remember being like an established Quentin Tarantino fan when Kill Bill came out.
That must have been fun for you.
So I was just like, whoa, I get to go see a Kill Bill movie, like the Quentin Tarantino movie in a theater. And I distinctly remember watching this movie for the first time and being kind of underwhelmed by it. Then as like the decades progressed, I keep on like, I watch it every now and then. And every time it's just like, damn, this movie is better than I thought. And like, damn, this movie is even better than I thought. And like, once I got to like the fourth time and like, you know, like 3 to 4 years apart of watching it, it's just like, this movie rips. And I think that this movie is like the movie that aged the best out of Tarantino stuff. Like, I think it's like a movie that like he's done a lot of stuff that just like either came out as an instant classic and has always been that, or it hasn't, but like this is like a snow, like this movie started as a snowball and grew into an avalanche, I think. And I think the best the best analogy I can make for this movie is I think that this is Quentin Tarantino's Burn After Reading. And like, Burn After Reading is another great movie, but like, what do you do after you make your masterpiece?
I mean, this was a really interesting time for Quentin. Yeah, because it was his follow up to Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
We'll talk more about where this stands, I think, in Quentin's overall filmography. It's interesting though, because I feel like you had a more typical experience with this movie than I did. This was actually, despite not being my favorite Tarantino, this was my gateway into Tarantino.
Really, this was my first Tarantino movie.
Yeah, my grandma showed it to me when I was a teenager, and I feel like I say
your
a lot.
Your grandma?
My grandma. Yeah, and
wait, tell me first off, what was your grandma's name? How is this a grandma?
Shout out to Beverly.
Yeah,
she's a. And I will say, I often say that I didn't grow up with a lot of cinephiles around me. I will say that my grandma is probably the exception to that. She is the one who, as I said, just got me into Tarantino with Jackie Brown. Yep. She was the one who got me into Hitchcock. She took me to a screening of The Birds with Tippi Hedren there. So shout out to Beverly. Hey, Beverly, you rule. No, she showed it to me because she was a flight attendant. And so it was, cool. I know, right?
Yeah.
Like,
okay.
It's like a cool, like, I looked at her a lot cooler after that. But yeah, this was my first Tarantino, which, like I said, I feel like is really unusual. Like, I feel like most people's is like yours, like Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs. But it's a really interesting way to start with Tarantino because I feel like in a lot of ways, it's not like any of his other movies.
I agree. I think it's his most traditional one, which is why I think it flies under the radar so much.
Mm-hmm. And I couldn't stop, but like, I don't want to go off too much of a tangent yet, but I couldn't stop thinking about actually his next movie, The Film Critic, while I was watching it, because I wouldn't be surprised if The Film Critic is more like Jackie Brown than any of his other movies. Like, you look at like Once Upon a Time and that feels like almost this big bombastic magnum opus where it's like, the film, from what I know of it, it looks like this could be a much a much more contained movie like Jackie Brown is. That's what really struck me on a rewatch. And I will say, I haven't returned to Jackie Brown since my badass grandma showed it to me when I was a teenager. But I watched it last night or a couple nights ago and really enjoyed it. Like, it is a solid heist movie. I don't think it's the most memorable of Quentin's films, but you know, I enjoyed it.
I don't think it's the most memorable of his either. As a matter of fact, like what I actually really like about it is that it feels like both a traditional, like a good traditional crime movie and a Quentin Tarantino movie at the same time. But it's just like, it's like a traditional crime movie first and a Tarantino movie second. Like, it still has like the Tarantino like dialogue flourishes, but like, it's not doing anything weird with the time. It has no gimmicks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and like Reservoir Dogs had a gimmick. I love Reservoir Dogs, but like, not showing the robbery is a gimmick, right? And like Pulp Fiction of like the time invert, like not the inversion, but the out of order sequencing, especially like, I know that like everything Quentin Tarantino does is borrowed and adapted from something else. But like, when Pulp Fiction, I assume, hit in 1994, and then when I saw it back in like what, the early 2000s, like that felt fresh and new and cool. And there is nothing fresh, new, or cool about Jackie Brown. Well, Jackie Brown's cool as f.
Like, I think she's with the fresh. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, like she's, but like, as far as like structurally, narratively, or filmmaking, from a filmmaking innovation standpoint, like, it doesn't do anything new. It's just a really well, like, it doesn't reinvent the wheel. It's just like a f-ing really nice wheel.
Yeah. Yeah. I am excited to dive into it more. So let's just do that. And by the way, like I said, this is an episode of the Not 100. So at the end, Cal is going to tell us where it is on his list and only his list. And then we'll reveal where that gets you in our little Billingsley bag. Look at this. Can we just...
Someone's a fan.
Because
every other one Someone's of those says fan. Top 100, no. And then this is customized.
Yeah. Shout out to Tayo, our producer. But yeah, let's get into the pedigree. So we've already talked about him a lot. It's Quentin. So like you said, it was his follow-up to Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
97, the last of his 90s movies. And I also find interesting, I didn't really think about this until I looked up, I was looking everything up. It is the longest, after Jackie Brown, he takes the longest break of his career thus far.
Yeah. Because it comes like, Kill Bill 1 is what, 2002, 2003?
Yeah, so it's 6 years.
Yeah.
And we haven't, I mean, we'll probably have a gap that long in between Once Upon a Time and The Movie Critic.
Yeah.
But he,
last film.
Yeah, and Astrid's important. Yeah. No, but I don't know if I want to say my favorite Tarantino, because that's just a big old spoiler. I feel I'll say it, whatever. My favorite is Kill Bill Volume 1. But this is a really good movie, and like we said, it, what really strikes me too is how it's probably his least violent movie.
This?
Yeah.
Oh, without question. There's only like two.
Well, there's two deaths. There's deaths in it, but you don't fully see them either. It's like even when Melanie is shot in the parking lot, it happens off screen.
Yeah.
I
Beaumont is done in an incredible. No, it's not off screen. It's on screen. It's just a super wide shot.
Yeah, it's basically off screen. Yeah, yeah.
But it's not. He's like 3 pixels, but it's 3 pixels of the screen.
We'll talk more about Beaumont because I like Beaumont as a character. And then Lewis, like I feel like that's very intentionally. You see him killed, like you see it from the back.
Yep, that's the third. But also great De Niro performance and a real offbeat De Niro performance.
Yeah, he's just playing a dude in this. I kind
of love that. It's one of the few idiots I think he's played.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
What other idiots has he played? I don't know.
I think you can make the argument that Rupert Pupkin is.
Okay.
But it's different, right? Like, at least like Rupert had like drive, and like part of the reason why you would like, I'm not gonna go as far as to call Rupert Pupkin stupid, I'm just saying that he doesn't pick up on social cues, and that is like the driving tension of that movie. I don't know if you've ever seen The King of Comedy, but like it's like a less violent Taxi Driver, and it's like, you know, it's like playing up scenes where it's like, I'm here to see him, and then she's like, I'm sorry, he's in a meeting, and then he's like, okay, I'll wait, and like doesn't pick, like it's like a lot of scenes where he's like, he doesn't pick up on the euphemism that it's like they're not gonna see you, so he just kind of like, you know, avoid, like isn't afraid of social awkwardness to get what he wants.
You could say that about Lewis. I think
Lewis is just a boob though, like he just kind of got out of the pan and he's just like, well, let me call up my buddy that I used to serve with like 20 years ago and see if he needs any, like if he needs a, you know, a goon.
Well, what I like about Lewis is I feel like you just constantly see it building. Like, you know this guy's history. You know he was in jail.
He's a bank robber.
He's a bank robber. And you can tell that he's, like, really trying not to snap. And then he has that moment, that great moment, which we'll talk about more because I think it might be my favorite moment, where he just snaps. He's such a good character. And, but yeah, we'll talk more. We'll talk more about Lewis. As far as cinematography goes, that was Guillermo Navarro, who is not a name I'm super familiar with. Are you super familiar with him?
No, I'm not. Should I know who he is?
Yes. I was like, I should know who this guy is. He would go on to win an Oscar for Pan's Labyrinth. He worked on a bunch of blockbusters, Hellboy, Zathura, Night at the Museum,
Cinegrim. So he's like Guillermo's guy. You worked with Guillermo a lot?
And I tried to find, too, if he had worked with Tarantino on anything else. I mean, he kind of did.
He's definitely been Guillermo's guy. He did Kronos.
I know. Yeah. Like, he's definitely, like, he didn't work really with Tarantino again, except for Dust Till Dawn, which wasn't directed by Quentin, but was written by him. So, like, kind of roundabout. But, like, this was the only Quentin collaboration. I found that very interesting. Obviously,
because I agree with you. I would say that From Dusk Till Dawn is more of a Robert Rodriguez.
It totally is. It totally is. Yeah. Of course, it was written by Quentin from a book, Elmore Leonard's Rum Punch. Have you ever read that?
I have not read Rum Punch, but I very much am a fan of Elmore Leonard. This is like a quintessential Elmore Leonard kind of movie. Like, and it's nice to see that it was like two being made at the same time, right? So it's not only like this one that was being made by Quentin Tarantino, but Out of Sight, which was made by Soderbergh, which is also like a fun, like,
I like Out of Sight. Yeah. Also, were you trying to make a pun with a quintessential?
No, but
there you go.
I am now.
If I had to tell you to shut up one more time, I'm gonna shut you up.
The real star here is Pam Grier.
Like, without question.
I mean, she's the title character. But it's something that I feel like Quentin is really good at, is kind of taking these characters who haven't had their big lead role yet and evoking this kind of, you know, and behind the scenes stuff aside, because we do know about some of the stuff with Uma Thurman, but I mean, he just evokes this great performance out of Pam Grier.
Yeah.
Like, she just, and I really, really, I think revisiting this movie, I really appreciate it more just because of her character. And one thing that I really like about this and Kill Bill, it's the women are obviously like gorgeous women and they're very captivating, but they're not, I feel like they're not sexy because they're sexualized.
No, I don't think Pam Grier is sexualized in this at all. I mean, they definitely comment that she is an attractive woman.
And she is.
Yeah. Without question, right? Yeah. But no one is like, she doesn't have sex in this film, like nothing like that. You know, she's always like, she's either wearing her stewardess outfit or she is wearing that power suit, you know?
And I would even like, this might sound counterintuitive, I don't even think Melanie is that sex. Like, yes, she's in Daisy Dukes in a bikini top the entire movie, but I feel like that it never like kind of lingers on and like on her, like, I mean, it lingers on her feet. We all know that.
Yeah. I think she's pretty sexualized. Cause then like one of my favorite scenes at the bar was like when De Niro and Samuel L. are talking and he's just like, but you had sex with her. He's like, yeah, I don't know.
It's but
like,
it's so unglamorous, she, that scene. Yeah. It's like
the scene where he's just like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Is she like your girlfriend or whatever? She's like, I just thought she was your girlfriend. And he's like, and you still had sex with her? And he's like, yeah, you know. He's like, well, I hope you felt appropriately guilty. And he's like, I did.
I love that scene. Yeah. But like, you also get the, and I think even in that scene, Samuel says like, oh, she's not very good at it, but she'll do it. Like you totally get the idea that Melanie kind of knows what she's got. Like, you know, she basically has sex with Lewis just to draw him in. And I think it's an interesting contrast, though, to Jackie Brown, because Jackie Brown just draws men in. Like, she has every single man in this movie wrapped around her finger.
Yeah.
And it's not just because she's beautiful. It is because she is so damn in control of everything.
And she's just utterly magnetic, right? Like, she knows, like, even, like, when she's in control, like, the way she handles, like, the cops, like, she doesn't cower from, like, Michael Keaton. You know, like they have a relationship. They go out and get dinner. Like she's working every angle.
Every angle. And everyone thinks they like know what she's doing. And no one does.
And like the only person, she actually likes, I guess the only way she gets sexualized, right, is at the end. Like her and Max Cherry kiss, right? So like that's the good
part. But even that, that felt really earned. Like I love that moment. I was like, I literally cheered. I forgot about it when I was rewatching it.
I guess what I was going to try and say is like what I love about like Max Cherry, like that particular thing is like she's just like the complete and utter badass and stuff like and totally in control, and the only other person that she like really associates with and like likes and finds attractive is like the humble bail bondsman that is also in control of like his small world and you know is like totally aware of what he's doing.
Well, that's another, and that's why I think Robert Forster is so good as Max Sherry, and I want to talk about him too, because like not to be reductive, but I forgot how damn attractive he is in this movie. And I think it's for the same reason that Jackie Brown is so attractive, just because he is so smart and he's not in control fully, because no one's really in control except for Jackie. But he just comes across as just so like kind of competent, and he sees more than, he's so good in this. And that's why I do like that they not end up together, but at least have that little kiss at the end.
Yeah.
And I also, like, I was trying to think, other than Breaking Bad, I don't know a lot of other roles that I know Robert Forster for. Breaking Bad was great. Yeah. He was great in that.
He was big in, like, the 70s.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I'm trying to think. Let me just pull up his known for right now. Oh, shit. He's in Mulholland Drive.
Oh, which is, wait, okay.
Which is basically, he got that role because of Max Cherry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then I think he got Breaking Bad because of Max. Yeah, yeah. No, but he's so good in this. And
he's in Twin Peaks. So.
Yeah, okay.
Actually, he didn't get that role because of Max Cherry. He got that role because him and fucking David Lynch go way back.
Yeah, but still, this, I'm sure it didn't hurt. Also, Bridget Fonda, I think she's maybe kind of an underrated player in this movie. Like, she's just, I just see her as this kind of, I don't know, this kind of stick that keeps poking and poking and poking, and that's kind of her role. And I think she could be written off Bridget Fonda as like, oh, any hot blonde girl could play her, but I think Bridget Fonda does a great job in this.
Yeah, I think so too. And I mean, like, she doesn't have like a ton of scenes, but the ones she's in are great, right? Like, even how like petulant she is in her introduction, like you get the fall and he's like, she just picks it up, it's for you, and then like goes and like sits back down. And then just starts footing.
I don't want to talk about that scene too much yet until we get into art of the scene, but I Love that scene. I think the whole dynamic between Ordell and Melanie, it's just, it's this really interesting dynamic of, they're both getting something out of it.
Yeah. No, they're using each other.
Oh, it's symbiotic, for sure. I don't even think they necessarily like each other. They seem to hate each other. And again, before I get into it, like, Samuel L. Jackson, he has this great, Ordell does, has this great line where he says, I don't trust her, but I trust Melanie to be Melanie. Yeah. And like, it's not that deep. It's just the devil you know is worse than the devil you don't, or better than the devil you don't. But it's just like, it's like little unexpected bit of wisdom that really struck me when I watched it a couple nights ago. But great cast. Also, Chris Tucker as Beaumont, really short-lived, literally role. But yeah, so let's talk prestige versus popcorn. This movie did pretty well. Had a tight budget of $12 million. Made $74.7 million back. That's a pretty solid.
I mean,
it's Quentin's follow-up to Pulp Fiction.
That's like kind of the interesting I think about it is like this is such a humble picture. You know?
It's so humble. It's a humble picture,
right? Like it's like there's the thing now, right? Where it's like if you make a banger, like, and few things are as big as Pulp Fiction, but if you make a banger now, right, you get your blank check film, right? Like after Christopher Nolan makes The Dark Knight, he gets a blank check. He makes Inception, right? Like, Ari Aster does a couple of good turns, right? He gets Beau is Afraid, you know?
Which is still, it's not quite like a huge blockbuster.
It's 3 hours.
It is 3 hours.
It is significantly a bigger budgeted film than what he has made previously.
You're not wrong, yeah.
You know? And like, all those people, it's like you kind of like succeed a bit, and then you get this like monster budget, and very few people have as big of a hit as Pulp Fiction and make as small of a picture to follow it up. Yeah. Another example is Alfonso Cuarón makes Gravity, big win, right?
Love that, yeah.
Roma.
Yeah, it's true that doesn't happen a lot anymore. Yeah. And you really do expect him to make, I mean, you expect Kill Bill after Pulp Fiction. I wonder if that's kind of why, it's like we were saying earlier, it's kind of one of his lesser appreciated movies. I wonder if it's because the expectations were just so high after Pulp Fiction.
That's what I'm trying to say. And I think that's why the burn after reading analogy is good too, right? Because like, what do you do after you make No Country for Old Men, right? They make this like quiet little like comedy that's like, very good. I don't know.
I'm with you. I like Burn After Reading.
Yeah, I don't know when the last time you saw Burn After Reading is, but that movie is awesome and it's like good, but it knows it'll never be as loud as No Country for Old Men, so it doesn't even try. And I think that's exactly what Jackie Brown does. And it's just a movie that like, I'm happy that it didn't shoot for the moon, because it's just been a slow burn of appreciation for all these years. And now I just like sit back and watch this and I'm just like, this is f-ing tight.
Like, it's good. Like every, you forget about how like good
every scene in this movie is just awesome.
I'm almost surprised to hear you say that, because like we were talking about this the other day, like you're a big proponent of like a shorter runtime, a reasonable runtime. Do you feel like this earns its runtime?
Yes.
I actually don't disagree. I think it does.
Yeah.
I think it does.
Because it also spends a lot, like the reason why I do think it earns its runtime, because it spends a lot of the time at the end, right? Like the climax, like the trade-off, right? And the thing what that does really, really well is it's the shell game. So you get to see the path of each shell and see what happens. And that just takes time, because what you're actually doing is taking, you know, like maybe 20 minutes of in real life time, but you're taking that 20 minutes and you're showing it from three different perspectives, which is like about an hour. And then he compresses it down to maybe like 45 minutes. And you're captivated for that entire end because you just want to know what happens to the money. And you don't get to see what happens to the money, despite the fact that you see the Billings, you know what happens to the Billingsley bags. Yeah. And that's what's so good about it. And that's like, so it could be a little longer because it's act three, like its climax is designed to be long because it's designed to be seen from multiple perspectives.
It is, and like, it's so weird too, because I was thinking, when I was trying to think of what scenes I wanted to talk about, I was kind of just going through the movie in my mind. And it feels like a lot happens, but it also doesn't feel like a lot does. Do you know what I mean? Like, it seems like there's a lot of reversals and a lot of changes in plans that are all kind of orchestrated by Jackie. But it's like when I actually sat down and said, and then this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens, it didn't feel like that many chain of events. And I have to say, credit to Sally Menk. I feel like you can't talk about her, Quentin, without her.
Yeah.
This movie is so well edited.
Yeah,
so tight.
That's what I'm saying. It earns its runtime. It doesn't feel fat because everything is working for a purpose.
Yeah. Again, credit to Sally. Like, this is such a well-edited movie. And I was really, because I was trying to think of, I thought it justified the runtime, and I was trying to think of what I would cut. And I'm like, I can't think of anything that I would cut. It's just a good, long heist movie.
Also, bear in mind, like, this movie is like, what, 230?
240, I think.
240?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Maybe with credits. Maybe without credits, like closer to 230.
Okay. Yeah. That's long.
Yeah, it's pretty long. Especially for the 90s too. Yeah. But it didn't get that much love at the Oscars. It was only
According to IMDb, it's 230.
Oh, it is 230?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe I was thinking with credits.
234.
Okay. I won't split hairs. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That is on the, I think once you hit the 240 mark, at least for me, and this is a totally arbitrary number, I'm sure everybody has their own thing, right? We know that I do not particularly like long movies. Right. But I think up to 230, I'm not going to ding you points. Once you start getting into 240 and 250, then it starts to become a very slippery slope.
Because sometimes I'll see a movie at like 215. I'll be like, really?
See,
like,
it won't turn me off. Like if I see a movie that's 245, I'm going into it angry that it's 245.
Yeah, I do that a lot.
Yeah. You know what I'm trying to say? Like, yeah. I don't go into a 230 movie thinking like, me, this is 230. And to your point, it may not earn that 230, but I'm not already mad at it going into it. But I'm usually mad walking into it 2 hour and 45 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Minutes.
When I was walking into my Avatar, The Way of Water screening, I was like, oh. And it was, well, I also felt like I had to see that for work, too. It was like, man, 3 hours.
I love that movie. I have never.
No, I didn't hate it either.
I'm like, going to say this. I think the genuine, and this is totally off topic. I think the genuine magic trick of Avatar, The Way of Water, which I fundamentally agree is an excellent film. Never in my life have I watched 3 hours of a movie, been so totally captivated, and then walked out of it and couldn't name one character except
you
for
could
Jake
say that,
Sully.
You could say that about the first Avatar.
I know.
That's what everyone says.
But that's what I love about it. Like, that's like, I genuinely think that that's a magic trick because I was like, I was wholly captivated and I still can't name anybody.
Yeah. I don't know if I could tell you what it was about. I mean,
it's like having a conversation with someone for like 3 hours and then forgetting their name the second
when
you
enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, they're lovely.
I had an excellent conversation. We were totally engaged.
Yeah.
And then you just like turn around and like, I forget who they were. I don't even know.
I will say, to bring it back to this, I feel like Quentin movies are not like that.
No, not at all.
I'm both entertained and I'm like,
well,
agonizing.
I couldn't even name the main character of Kill Bill though.
I mean, yeah.
It's a joke.
I know. I couldn't name the lead character of this one. Mm-hmm. Just kidding. It's Jackie Brown. It didn't get that much Oscar love, though.
No.
Only of anyone to be not, and this is not a slight, I was surprised to just see Robert Forster.
That's it? Not even best adapted?
Nope. Nope.
Wow.
Just Robert Forster for best supporting actor. And like, don't get me wrong, he deserves it. But like, come on, lead actress for Pam Grier. Are you kidding me? I mean, even Samuel L. Jackson, I feel like, might have.
Yeah, no, this is a great Samuel L. role.
It's great. He's so good at it. And like, I think he's playing a very similar character that he plays in a lot of other Quentin movies and a lot of other stuff in general.
Yeah, but he gets a lot of time here.
He does. He's, I think, would be the second lead.
He's the antagonist of the film.
And he's not a good dude. He's a really
dude. He's great.
Yeah, but he's very charismatic. I agree. And I think this is also like this, if you look at the timeline, I mean, this is what got him like, I mean, they're maligned now, but the Star Wars prequels, I mean, and.
Are they maligned now?
I think they are having a bit of a resurgence.
I think they were maligned then. I think like all these Zoomers grew up just like watching the prequels and, you know, they have the rose colored glasses that we don't.
I think, well, and I also think there's like certain love for the actors resurfacing, like Hayden Christensen. Who,
for sure.
Yeah. I mean, he deserves it. But like, you have to think about like Mace Windu, I think, is one of the coolest characters in Star Wars. Maybe that's a hot take.
When is Samuel L. Jackson not the one of the coolest guys?
Even, I don't think it exists.
You can make the argument that he's not one of the coolest guys in Goodfellas because, you know, he's.
Yeah.
He's just the guitar player that forgets to drop off the truck and then, you know, dies. But he's still the guitar player. Like, he's just like, oh, yeah. Like, even the mobsters were like, yeah, he's the cool guitar player from the bar. Let's have him drive the truck.
He hasn't been you know what? I'll say, like, commenters, if you have a role where he's been uncool, tell us. Because I can't think of one where he's not been
cool. What was it, Changing Lanes? I think he might be uncool in that movie. Isn't that movie with him in, like, Cusack? And he starts off uncool in...
But then he gets cool, I assume.
In Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Oh.
Yeah, because he's like the nerd. He's got the glasses and he's just like yelling at the kids. But that
didn't even feel genuine.
He's just yelling at the kids and then like, then he's in it.
Yeah. No, but it's a great Samuel L. role. I was just so shook when I saw that. Actually, I should have looked this up before then. I wonder if it got any Golden Globes. Oh, yeah. So it did. Oh, that's interesting. So like I said, it got a nomination for Forrester at the Oscars. But the Golden Globes gave nominations to Samuel L. Jackson and Pam Grier. They got it right, I think.
Did they not win, though?
Nominations. Yeah. So still not quite got it. I wonder who they lost to. I probably should have looked that up. So Titanic is not in the Golden Globe nomination. She lost to Helen Hunt for As Good As It Gets. I called no. I don't think that's right. She's great. I like As Good As It Gets. But come on, Pam Grier. Come on, Globes. Oh, also, that's a pretty stacked category that year. Julia Roberts for My Best Friend's Wedding. Jennifer J-Lo for Selena. Interesting category that year. But no, I just can't believe Pam Grier didn't get an Oscar nomination. But critics generally liked it. Although when I was looking up... reviews, I do feel like there was the Pulp Fiction effect. I feel like it was maybe unfairly, not maligned, but unfairly overhyped or whatever it is because of Pulp Fiction. But overall, it was successful. Like, it did well.
Yeah.
It did well.
I mean, it made $70 million on 12.
Yeah.
When does that happen anymore?
And then we got Kill Bill, which, as I've noted, I love that movie.
You make what, $13,000 a year?
I make $16,000 plus benefits.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out the Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Find the Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
So let's talk about some great moments. I feel like I often start at the very beginning, but...
It's because this movie deserves to be started at the very beginning.
Yes. I love... Okay, you know what I love about this opening sequence? I mean, first of all, it's... You immediately get that she's in control, which is something that carries through. Even when she's like doing a little jog, she's like, oh no.
It's also just like a beautiful homage to The Graduate, right?
Oh, yeah.
It starts like, and like what I like about it is like the juxtaposition of it, right? So it's like static camera, her standing still, And, you know, it's just like, hello, darkness, my old friend. But they're doing it to like 110th Street, like that song. So she's just like going against the exact same wall as Dustin Hoffman did in The Graduate. And then, you know, she gets off the walkway and she's like walking. And then like it starts to get a little more hectic, like she's trying to get to that flight. And then they still keep the shot. But this time, instead of her standing still, she's booking it down like down the terminal. And it's like still keeping the same framing, but it's like a very fast pan on like dolly tracks. It's so cool. I just like how they juxtapose it like that.
Well, the other thing I love about this is that you don't see her for another 30 minutes after this. I totally lost that. Like when I was rewatching, I totally forgot that she's barely in the beginning of this movie. But like, obviously she's the tight, she's the movie is called Jackie Brown. And I feel like this like intro just kind of sets the stage where no matter what, like have this character in your mind, she's going to come back. And at the end, she's going to own all of this.
Yep.
And it's just, I feel like it's just really weirdly, just like very pleasing to look at. Like,
I mean, like she's just not in like what, four scenes? Cause it's basically like, this is Jackie Brown. And then it's like, all right, let's start talking about who Odell Robbie is. And he needs off Beaumont.
Yeah.
And then like after they take care of all that, then like she's at the airport getting taken in by Ray.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Ordell, because he has this great little intro too, I think.
That whole, almost that whole first act is all him, and it's excellent.
Yeah. And that's the thing, like he is, I don't know if he's, I would call him a, I would call him a co-lead with Pam Grier.
Yeah.
He's definitely a co-lead. And like you said, he's the antagonist. But I love this little opening sequence where you get the women with guns, because it just feels like so American.
You know what's disturbing is like how accurate that like is.
It still feels that way. Like, you know, 20 years later.
I actually feel like America grew into that.
Yeah.
As opposed to like out of it. Like the NRA does all of these like crazy, like with YouTube and stuff like that. Like there's like an NRA channel and stuff like that. And they do all this like very, very pretty much that video version of like, hey, here, like women love guns too, you know, kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, granted, that video is more male gazy because, you know, there's no reason for like women in bikinis to just be shooting guns, but it's very funny. And like the statue, the Statue of Liberty shooting the Tommy gun is incredible.
I mean, it's true though. It does feel more accurate now than it did then. I mean, it is a chicken and egg, Quentin Curry in America. But it's such a good little scenes that are this whole scene, because like we said earlier, you get this dynamic between Melanie and Ordell. And it's at first you're kind of thinking that she might be a little subservient to him, because I think the first interaction is him being like, my drink's empty, go get another one.
Yeah.
And then she does it. But then you have that very pouty, like when she answers the phone.
Yeah.
And she's like, and she doesn't even tell him who it is. She just like sits there and pouts.
And I also like it too, because it's not like, oh, this guy sells guns, right? It's like, there's a real easy way to do that where you see him sell a gun. Instead, it's just like, hey, like he's showing his buddy, like, look at this f-ing video. And like, he's like giving him the sales pitch on all the guns all the while. Like they're just pounding screwdrivers and sitting by the beach.
It seems like it seems like a nice way, a nice day. It's like,
it sounds
they're
like
in their
great
little
morning.
Beach house, like watching guns and drinking screwdrivers. Yeah. But I do think that whole little location is so unassuming, and that's why I like it so much. Like I think he says later that like Melanie's just his little surfer girl, and you totally get that from that, like this location, that setup. It's secretly a very good location. Yeah. I feel like so unassuming. But you also kind of get to know Lewis is, and I kind of read him in this scene as someone who kind of just like goes with the flow, and he basically is like most of the movie.
He's like a bumbling, mumbling guy. It's just like I'll take it. Right.
Yeah.
You know, it's great.
Yeah. No, I really like this.
It sets up all three of them, and it like ends on the motivation of like that serene morning, just like drinking screwdrivers and watching like gun tapes. Is like, well, Beaumont's in jail.
I have to work now. That's what I got from it too. I was like, I would be pissed. And then you kind of have the same thing when he like pulls after he bails out Beaumont, and then like pulls him out from like his little night of smoking weed, and Beaumont's just like, I don't want to, like, I was focused on not doing anything tonight.
Honestly, I think that's like one of the better written overall one of the better written scenes in the film. Because like what I like about that scene in particular is like Beaumont just got out of jail. He's going there to kill him. We may not know that at that moment in time.
Yeah. Right?
But like you may even think it, but you don't know it for sure. Mm. And like the way that scene is written, it's written so well, right? Beaumont wants to just sit home and get stoned. And Odell is like, dude, I got you out of jail. I need a favor. And he's like, I don't know. He's like, I got you out of jail. He's like, all right, fine. Well, what's the favor? And he's like, well, I got to go sell some guns to some people I didn't meet. So I need some backup. And he's like, I don't know. He's like, I got you out of jail. So he gets him like downstairs and he's just like, I need you to get in this trunk. And he's like, I'm not doing that. He's like, listen, I just need you to get in there and just like, when I open this trunk, rack this shotgun, scare these people and go. And it takes like a little bit of convincing, but the idea that like the shotgun was there, like an unloaded shotgun, is such a great, well-written way to give anybody a false sense of comfort.
Yeah,
because he's like, well, I'm gonna be sitting in this trunk with his shotgun at least, you know, and like puts him in the trunk. And then there's that incredible crane shot, which is like the car pulls out, just makes a U-turn, and it just cranes up and you just see the car drive into the dirt, that dirt patch, like that industrial zone. And then he just walks out of the car and shoots him all in one shot in that like real, real wide shot. It's incredible. And that's like the end of Beaumont. And now we're like three scenes deep with Odell, and you know that he's a gun salesman, right? He has the money to get his friend out of jail, and then he shoots them because he knows that Beaumont isn't the kind of guy that could do 10 years.
Mm-hmm. It's funny too, because back to what you were saying about, you know, do we know he's gonna kill Beaumont? Or like I kind of had that same thought process where I was like, he may be going to kill Beaumont, because I really didn't remember this movie very well. But once he opens that trunk, you're like, oh, he's dead. And I was trying to figure out if Beaumont knows he's dead.
No, and that's what
he totally doesn't. Yeah.
And that's like what the gun does. Yeah. It's like, oh, no, he needs me. There's a gun here.
Yeah, yeah. I'm here for a job.
Yeah.
Also, like, I was, for a brief moment, I was kind of on Ordell's side because I was like, he did just get you out of jail.
And that's like the kind of thing. It's like so well written because everything that guy is saying, like everything Odell is saying is totally plausible.
Yeah.
He could have, like, I can't imagine that like selling illegal firearms is a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's an on-demand kind of thing.
But that's the thing. You kind of do have to be on call.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. But like, it is funny too, because I feel like in the beginning of the movie, you just hear the name Beaumont, Beaumont, Beaumont over and over and again. And I think that's part of like the, like, oh, is he good? I thought he was maybe going to be a big character.
Yeah.
And also he's Chris Tucker. Like, nope. He's gone. But I do wonder too about that scene. Like you mentioned, you have that big wide shot, kind of back to, you know, this film being one of the less violent Quentin movies. I kind of wonder how much of that is a response to criticism of Pulp Fiction. Cause like at a certain point, I think Quentin does just say, I don't give a F, and does what he wants to do. But it does feel like so much of this movie is intentionally not trying to show the violence. And I love that shot, but I do wonder, is like, was that him being like, okay, well, I'll do less blood this time?
Yeah. So, you know what the interesting thing about it is? Is like, I actually think what's like really fascinating about it is the buildup, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, it's in that scene, it's a very, very long shot where it just like kind of lingers as he like drives the car around. When he goes to kill Jackie and she talks her way out of it, it's him walking to the house, like putting on the gloves. And he has like that very distinct way of how he puts on his hitman gloves. You know, like he puts them on and he's just like pushing down all the gaps in between the fingers.
Well, he's a professional. He's done this. Yeah.
And like that too is a single shot that's tracking from when Odell gets out of the car to Jackie's front door. So it's like, you know, it's the anticipation of it, which is really good. And I think that plays into the drama of it all. And mm-hmm. I think that's a really good job to play. Like it's a really good, like Hays code level technique of like playing into into the drama of like, you know, Bruce the Shark, you don't see the hit, but you understand, like, you know, it's kind of scary. Cause like it does it does such a good job of like not only telegraphing it but building the anticipation by like not cutting.
Well, that's true though, because like I was saying, it's kind of anyone's guess before he goes in the trunk, and then once he opens the trunk, you're like, oh, he's dead, and then you're just kind of tense for it, and then there
he gets in the car, he puts on the gloves, you know, and then like he pulls the gun out of the glove box and just drives around the corner, and then it's like a big wide shot, and it's just.
Yeah. And it's funny because I when I was thinking about scenes that I wanted to talk about, this is really between this and Jackie's introduction, I don't really have that many in that first 30 minutes, but that's not so much a complaint. Like, I feel like the first 30 minutes of this movie are really strong, even without mostly Jackie not being there. And it is because Samuel L. Jackson. And I feel like he's only so good in this because he's such a plausible antagonist to Jackie, which that says a lot, because Jackie, I think, is the smartest character in this movie, obviously. But like he's on his shit too. Like he knows what he's doing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, two things is funny. It's like he has $500,000, and I think the movie does a good job of making $500,000 seem like it's like he's done.
Yeah,
I could stop life now. I have $500,000. I'm good. I'm ready to retire.
Yeah.
But like.
You could retire on $500,000. I think.
No, you can't.
It depends how old you are. If you live really modestly.
Old. He's in his 40s.
He just has like a beach house. He's not in a mansion.
Do you think he's not? I mean, he's paying like 3 rents. I don't even think we know what house is his, right? Because he talks about how he has Melanie in the beach house.
Oh, right?
He has Simone, where Lewis is staying with the woman that does like the Motown dance for him, and then he has the other girl that like his country girl that he has up in Compton, and like remember when he complains like the house looks like this is some repugnant shit. So he's like keeping up 3 households, and you mean to tell me that this man is going to retire on $500,000?
He has investments. He's smart. I think, you know, he could sell he has real estate. He could liquefy.
Does he? We don't know that he owns.
I would assume he owns.
I mean, I guess if you're selling guns. Well,
I feel like we're getting really into the weeds on Orto. But like I said, I don't really have any other big scenes up until Jackie's. And I feel like not that much time goes by until we have Jackie, but it is like 30 minutes.
I love that. I agree with you. And I love the Max Cherry scenes are great. Because what's so good about them is that they're so procedural. Like, this is what Max does every day. Some guy comes into his office, sits down, gives him money. He's just like, all right. And then they leave. Even when Odell comes to bond out Jackie Brown, he's just like, well, can we just use the 10 grand on Beaumont because he's dead to bail out Jackie? And he's like, and then Max is like, well, this is all the paperwork I have to go through. He's like, whoa, I just trying to get her. I was like, great. All you have to do is give me $1,000. That's all the stuff I have to do.
Well, to your point about it being procedural, it does like, it almost does feel like a clip out of a cop show for like half a second. Like he is just, this is what he does day to day. This is his job. And you really get the idea that Max Cherry is a very like kind of normal dude, but I think I think you learn that he isn't. I think you learn that he's a lot deeper. And that's what I really like about Jackie Brown. And that's what I like about, honestly, Quentin movies in particular. Like, there are so many well-developed characters. You look at Jackie, you look at Odell, you look at, like, Lewis. Everyone's just so well-developed. Like, Melanie, I would say, is well-developed.
You know what else is fun, too, right? When Max bonds out Jackie and, like, they go to the bar, like, I'm pretty confident. I don't know this for sure, but I'm supremely confident that bar is the exact same location that Marcellus Wallace convinces Butch to throw the fight.
I wonder if that's true.
I think it is. The bars look very similar.
I mean, location, that could be.
I mean, they're Los Angeles movies, you know?
That's the thing. They reuse locations a lot. That's why I think it might be plausible. But I want to talk about that bar scene, too, because it immediately, like, the red lighting, it just kind of immediately throws sexual tension at you. It's like, you can tell these characters are into each other. But this is really where you get to see Jackie, like, do her thing immediately.
I like that scene. She's just like, can we go to a dark bar? I don't want to look like I just got out of jail.
I get it. Yeah. I wouldn't want to look like I just got out of jail either. No, but I really like that scene.
Why does it have to be dark?
Because it looks like I just got out of jail. That's why.
There's a lot of scenes in this movie where it's just two people talking in a bar. Another one that I really like later is the conversation between Jackie and Ardell, where I think he's trying to kind of figure out if she's playing him or
she
not.
She talks her way into living. He went there to kill her.
Oh, he totally did.
Yeah.
And there was, by the way, like, not to, well, actually, it was right after this scene where the apartment scene where, like, he kind of sneaks up on her. Like, there's sexual tension in there, too. But again, like, I didn't see a moment where Jackie wasn't completely in control.
To your point, right? Like, I think one of the coolest Jackie scenes of all time is, and or at least to the character, right, of how in control she is, of the calculated gamble that she's going to put the $500,000 under all of her stuff, right? So she's just like, well, how do you know they're not going to check? And it's like total con man thing, which is just like, well, he expects to see $50,000. He'll see $50,000. Why would he dig any deeper? That is like peak in control kind of
thing.
That's
like psychological. Yeah. Like, you know everything they're going to do.
Yeah.
And there's that great scene where she's with the ATF agents and they're really kind of trying to undersell her like as a human being. They're kind of making fun of her for being a flight attendant who only makes $17,000 a year, which
with is benefits.
Very, with benefits, but that's still very little. But it's like, even then, you know, she's just looking at these idiots like, oh, I'm going to play you. Yeah. Like, oh, it's so good. She might be like, now that I've revisited it, she might be one of my favorite Quentin characters because she's so goddamn cool. But were there any other scenes in this little portion?
Let's see. In the middle, not so much. It's just like, because like it's not that anything it's not that anything is bad. It's just like very procedural, right? So it's all setting up of like, okay, here are the players, right? You got the ATF. So I have to like sneak around the ATF to get Odell his money, but I'm trying to rip off Odell as well. So it's like it's like the middle is lining up all of the chess pieces. And like we talk about them because there's like really funny moments in there, right? Like when like Lewis is talking to Odell about how he felt bad about sleeping with Melanie. And like there's also, but then there's also like, you know, her working with Jackie working with the ATF, and like that relationship is like really funny because it's like, you know, they think that they're the tiger.
Well, also, I don't even think we've said Michael Keaton's name yet.
Who's incredible.
Who's so good. And it's like, I was thinking about this when I was like trying to, you know, looking at my notes. I thought about Michael Keaton so little, but he's also so good in this. And I think it's just because this cast is so obscenely stacked and everyone's so good in it. But like, yeah, Michael Keaton's great.
Yeah, he's so good in that. He reprises the role in Out of Sight.
Yeah, but like, which is really fun to me. Yeah.
And like Quentin, like, you know, basically made Universal give them allow that character to be used as an uncredited cameo.
Just so funny to me. For free. Just for fun.
Yeah.
Just
Miramax for fun. Gave it to Universal for free, just on Quentin's demand.
Yeah.
And for fun.
At
he's
that
just
time,
like,
he could demand.
Yeah, 100%. And just because, like, Quentin's just like, yeah, Keaton knocked this out of the park. This is just a cool Easter egg.
It is. And it was. It's a cool Easter egg. But no, it's so fun. I feel like they have great comedic relief just because you just know they're clowns. You know they're so stupid and they think they're so smart, but they're not. But I don't know if I'm jumping ahead. I actually really like the scene with Lewis and Melanie where she's like convincing Lewis.
Where she's needling him and then.
Yeah. That's the death. Well, oh, yeah, she's also needling. She's needling the whole time.
Yeah.
Like she's
the bathroom before they go?
No, the scene where they do it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I first of all, you just get that this character, I don't think she's stupid, Melanie. I think she is pretty smart, but it's like also a little impulsive because
I don't know where you're getting that from.
It was really stupid to just assume that Lewis would go with her. Because I was like, he's shown no evidence that.
Like, I think I agree with you insofar as I think Melanie thinks Melanie is smart.
I don't think she's as dumb as maybe she could have been.
She's one of three deaths.
Yeah, I mean, but Lewis isn't a total idiot, and he died.
Yes, he is.
Who's the other? Oh, Beaumont's an idiot.
Yeah,
I don't think Lewis is totally an idiot.
Again, I don't know what would lead you to that conclusion.
Maybe
I'm not saying he's.
I feel like they're stupid in comparison to Odell and Jackie, but I feel like they're normal people. intelligence wise.
So you think they're, so you think that Bone, or I think Beaumont is probably.
Okay. Here's my argument for Melanie.
Yeah.
I think she has gotten a really nice, a nice life for herself. She lives, I would assume, rent free in this nice little beach house. She has Odell, who I would assume is not there much of the time. And that's the way she likes it. She pretty much can walk around and do whatever she wants. She only messed it up because she, you know, kind of went.
Got greedy.
Yeah. But I think before that, she kind of used what she had.
Yeah. But is that, is using what you have in that capacity, like genuine intelligence, like, you know, like alpha level intelligence, or she just kind of like got an easy hand?
I don't know. But she also kind of navigates this relationship with Odell kind of.
Because I guess like all I'm trying to say is like this film weaves an intricate maze, right?
Yeah.
One person walks out with $500,000. A lot of people get nothing. And three people die. And she's one of the three people that dies.
Dying doesn't make you stupid.
Doesn't make you smart either.
But I think she, I will say she knows what she has. And I don't know. I'm curious. Did you think that Lewis was with her in this scene before they go to the bar with Odell? Because I went back and forth because I was like, I don't think he's actually with Melanie on this one.
I don't think so at all.
Yeah.
I don't think he's with her at all.
He was always going to sell her out.
It's not so much that he was always going to sell her out, but like if he was with her, he wouldn't have shot her.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we learned that later.
Yeah. So I don't think he was ever with her now.
Yeah. It's a funny little scene though. Just the whole like they have sex and it's the most unglamorous thing you've ever seen. Like it's not at, to our point earlier. It's not at all sexual. Hey,
listen, according to Odell, she's not even really that good at it.
That made me laugh so much. She's not good at it, but she does it.
I believe he said she'll throw somebody a fuck, which is just a hilarious term.
Yeah, but that's what she did. She
she just threw him
and
a
I
fuck.
Think he said something along the lines of like maybe like Lewis kind of needed the
Yeah, he just got out.
He just got out, you know? He's just going to hit it in 3 minutes and call it a day. But I talked about it earlier, but I do really like that scene between Odell and Lewis in the bar.
Yeah, that scene's great.
It's great. And it's like, again, I love that line of like, I can't trust Melanie, no, but I can trust her to be like to be Melanie.
I can trust Melanie to be Melanie.
Yeah, and that's what she did. Yeah. She was Melanie about it. But then we have the whole mall, the Dalama Mall heist.
Yeah, basically, it's like the three card Monty scene, right? Because it's you know like who has it's the shell game, right? Like who has the Billingsley bag with the money?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's and like I don't know like. The whole entire time. And I feel like this is where Pam Grier really acts the heck out of this movie. Because I love when she's, I mean, I'm jumping ahead, but at the
end. I like that you're saying heck, despite the fact that I've been saying throw a
I'm being considerate to the editors. She acts the heck out of it. Because you have her, like, you have her being very charismatic with, God, what's her name? The person who she's, like, swapping with.
Yeah.
But then you also, like, you have her acting frazzled at the end. And you have her, like, acting, like, she's just. But then also you have this great scene between her and Max. And another line that I really like, is he asks, or she asks Max, would you take $500,000? And you know, she says it wouldn't be missed. And he says $500,000 would be missed anywhere.
Yeah. $500,000 will always be missed.
That's where it is. Yeah. But it's like, and you can tell he's totally avoiding the question too. And she calls him on it. She's like, you're not answering the question. Like, I love their, it's, you never fully get until the end really that the walls are really down with them, which is why I feel like the end is so rewarding. The little kiss at the end. And even then I feel like still like the walls are up a little bit.
Yeah, for sure.
But I also do, I like that mall scene. I like that it takes place in a mall. Like it's a very 90s mall. You know, everything about it is just so unassuming. But that little, the heist in the dressing room is fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so good. It's just, it's so much fun, you know? And like I said, like even like watching, like, give me the bag, right? Like when you see like Lewis and Melanie, like jostling over the Billingsley bag, she's like, you're going to rip it. It's just like,
yeah.
And like, again, talk about like, you know, the con of it all, that no one looked at the money. It felt right.
I know. It felt right. It didn't feel like unbelievable. Yeah. It just felt like that. That is what would happen. Yeah.
Someone just threw a lot of Elmore Leonard novels in a box, in a bag with a beach towel.
The beach towel. But I think I said earlier, I still think my favorite scene in the movie is the parking lot scene where Lewis finally kills Melanie. Because, like, I kind of, again, I barely remembered this movie when I watched it a couple nights ago. So I was surprised by certain things. I had a feeling Melanie would die. I just didn't know it would be.
You had a feeling Melanie would die because she was so smart?
Because she was in over her head. I'm not saying she's a genius. I'm not saying, I don't think she was an idiot. Well, in some ways. I don't know. I think she had a good thing going.
I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, why would you needle a guy with a gun?
Well, she needled Odell, though. Like, she constantly poked at Odell. And I don't know if I think there maybe was an implication that their relationship was a little violent. Because I think at some point he says, like, why didn't you just... Oh, when after he kills Melanie, Odell's like, why didn't you just punch her?
Yeah, why didn't you just hit her?
Yeah. But, like, she wasn't shot by Odell, who seems much more, like, it seems like he would kill her more.
I mean, no, because, like, Odell doesn't operate under impulse. Like, his murders are calculated.
But that's why I like this scene, because it doesn't seem like Lewis acts under impulse, like, until then, because it's just, no. And it happened so suddenly, I literally gasped. It was one of those moments where I was like, oh, like, so that might be my favorite. And also, like, I don't know why, but I laughed a little bit just because it was so, like, out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Like,
it's just like...
Yeah. But then you have Lewis's death.
Yeah.
Which wasn't...
You were beautiful, man.
Yeah. You get the idea that, like, Odell is genuinely kind of heartbroken.
Yeah.
Like, that was his friend. Yeah. He kind of trusted him.
Well, he did trust him.
Yeah.
And then he was just like... But that was like the, oh, you're stupid.
Yeah.
I hired someone stupid. I hired two stupid.
Why didn't you just punch her?
Yeah.
But the ending of this movie, you know, with Jackie, you know, getting pulled in with the ATF agents, like, again, just one last, like, she's in control of this. Stop thinking that you're
100%.
Yeah.
He's got a gun.
Yeah. So good. Before the very end of this movie, though.
Oh, one last thing.
Yeah.
You know what I very much appreciate? It's just like the fun homages, right? Right. So, like, the beginning, it has, the graduate homage. But what I just thought was fun is, like, you know, like, so she's waiting for Odell to come, right? And he has the gun in the desk drawer.
Mm-hmm.
So she just practices pulling it out.
Yeah.
And it's very Taxi Driver.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is.
You know, and it's just like, it's very much the, like, are you talking to me without saying it? It's just like, she's just trying to get, like, the draw down. And that's, you know, a scene that her co-star made very famous, like, 30 years before. And you could see it's, like, similar angles and stuff like that. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is fun.
Quentin likes movies. He likes
I think he's seen a couple, yeah.
I think he's seen a couple,
yeah.
At least. But really, the only last scene that I want to talk about is the nice little kiss. It was like, I don't know why I didn't expect it, but I, like, again, I literally, like, I was like, yay.
Yeah, it's also
nice.
It's also, like, it's a movie that's, like, you know, like, tight and exhilarating the entire time, but it has the good ending, you know?
Yeah, it has the good ending, and you don't know if Max and Jackie ultimately end up together. I don't think they do. I think they kind of just go
separate ways.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's what it is. But it's nice. It's you know, the one kind of real relationship in that movie ended up being Jackie and Max, and it felt like they gave it to us.
Yeah.
Felt like, yeah, they're like, here you go. I forgot how much I like this movie.
It's because it's really good.
Yeah, I'm glad we're talking about it.
I'll send you a postcard.
Will you?
I sure will, partner.
So we've basically talked through this whole movie.
Yeah.
Should we talk about the movie list?
Yeah.
Let's do that. Let's talk about what list is on.
Yeah.
Just one. Our heist movies.
Yeah. Honestly, if there was only one list for it to be on, that's the one it should be on. Without question. I think it's such a fun heist. You know, like, she could also be a best criminal.
Mm-hmm.
If we ranked criminals. Because, you know, like, the female criminals are... There's not many. And I don't mean, like, murderers, you know, like...
I mean, there aren't a lot of them,
like,
yeah.
You know, because, like, you get, like... There's always, like, the crazy woman, you know, murderer. That's kind of a stereotype. But, like, thieves and stuff like that, not as much. Jackie Brown stands out as like a consummate hustler that mm-hmm. is just like completely affable, always in control. She's just like, it is a role that if this was a man, it would be like a Paul Newman or Robert Redford role.
I honestly don't even know if I would like it. Like, I gotta be honest.
No. Yeah. I'm not like, but like she exudes that kind of like energy. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes her so compelling. Like just always in control and like consummately cool at any time. Never seems flustered.
And to that point, it was our example of hurdles thrown at the protagonist because she is thrown so many hurdles and just kind of, you never see her like, I think visibly stress.
No.
She's just like, all right, let's move on to the next obstacle. Let's move. She's great. I was thinking about like lists that she could be on that I don't know, but like femme fatales.
I don't know if that constitutes as femme fatale, but like there's a lot of shit going on there. And like she's goading a lot of people to do stuff. And I guess what I'm trying to say is it's a very loose interpretation of the term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that. And I feel like femme fatale usually is not the lead character.
Yeah.
Usually it's like a side character.
And it's usually like the path to someone else, another character's downfall.
Yeah. I mean, she is a lot of people's downfall, but that's not her main role.
Yeah.
Are there any other lists that this should be on? I don't know. Like, I think of this as a heist movie.
Yeah. It's not going to be on like 90s movies because, you know, this is like Quentin's like quiet third, you know.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, it's not even the top of, as much as I have realized I like it, it's still not the top of my Quentin list.
Yeah. I don't think that this is a blaxploitation film.
That's a big debate. I don't think it is.
It's very influenced by them.
Very influenced.
But I don't know if this... I mean, it's made by a white guy, so can it even be?
I think... I'm trying to think if it's trying to be. Like, I don't think it is.
I don't think it is. No, yeah. I think it's trying to be a Quentin Tarantino movie.
Yeah.
But, like...
But the inspirations are extremely obvious.
Yeah.
Shall we Torf?
Sure.
All right. Things you didn't know. Now, if you we call this Torf here, but this is true or false, I'm gonna read some facts to Cal, right. And some will be true, some I'll just be lying,
so
like Jackie Brown.
Actually facts.
Yeah, they're facts. Yeah. So I'm just gonna read them to you, and you're gonna tell me if they're real or not real.
Let's go.
All right. This movie has the lowest body count of any of Quentin Tarantino's films.
Absolutely true.
You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as we've said, only four people die.
Four. Who's the fourth?
Wait.
So you got Odell. You got Beaumont.
Melanie.
You got Melanie, and you got...
Oh, wait, no, I mixed it up.
And you got... yeah, you're right. And you got...
Lewis. Oh, yeah, it is four. It is four. Only 9 shots are fired, and 4 squibs of blood are seen used. Again, we talked about you don't see a lot of the violence.
Yep.
Kill Bill Volume 2 has only 3 on-screen deaths. However, it has several characters killed during a flashback scene. So, like... Kind of a cop-out, but...
They're on camera.
Yeah.
As long as they're on camera, it counts.
It's still the body count, you know? All right. True or false?
Yeah.
Samuel L. Jackson filmed his scenes on the weekend because he was shooting Sphere during the week. True or false?
True.
You're right. 2 out of 2.
I mean, listen, Sphere was a big budget movie, so I could definitely imagine, like, that's putting, like, stories on his house, and he's just doing this one to be cool.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. He was so in, like, this was his time. Yeah. Being as in demand as he was, Jackson was actually shooting another major movie at the same time as Jackie Brown, sci-fi thriller Sphere, alongside Dustin Hoffman and Sharon Stone.
I can assure you Sphere is not going to be anywhere near this top 100 list.
It would be really funny if I got really offended and said it was, like, in my top 10. It's not. However, as Jackson and Tarantino were both keen for him to play Odell and Jackie Brown. I mean,
there's no way that was going to anybody else.
No, they worked around it. Like that must kind of have been a pain in the butt around, like just on the weekends. But you make it work for him.
I mean, think about it. It's a $12 million movie. So like how much of that is like Samuel L. Jackson's cut? $12 million.
Gosh, I don't know. Yeah. But you
Sphere, like, $12 million is what Sphere was spending in like a week.
Remember Sphere?
Hold on, I want to know what the budget of Sphere is.
I love that his like big commitment was Sphere, during the 5 days of the week was Sphere.
quick interneting here. Sphere was $80 million.
Yeah. Wow. And we don't talk about Sphere anymore, do we?
No, we do not.
We kind of talk about Jackie Brown. All right, so you're 2 for 2. Good job. All right, true or false? In order to maintain his character's look in Sphere, previously mentioned. Samuel L. Jackson's character in Jackie Brown also dons long hair and a goatee. So basically, because of the two movies.
False.
Wait, yeah, you got another one. Yeah, it was Samuel L. Jackson's idea to give his character the long hair and braided goatee. It was inspired by characters from his favorite kung fu films. I think it works really well here.
Oh, I do too. Yeah. It also looks like it. It also looks weird, you know.
Like, I feel like at the end, especially. Yeah, you know, it totally works. Okay, you're 3 out of 3.
All right.
True or false?
Yeah.
Michael Keaton had to talk Quentin Tarantino into casting him. Really had to sell him on it.
False.
You're correct. Damn, you're on it.
I'm pretty sure he was cast in Out of Sight first, and then Quentin decided to use him in the role because their movie was in production first.
But the glimmer of truth here is not that Keaton had to talk Quentin into it, but that Quentin had to talk Keaton into it. In the wake of Reservoir Dogs, and Pulp Fiction, most of the biggest stars were lining up to work with Quentin Tarantino. However, Keaton just wasn't that into it.
I'm wrong.
You're wrong?
He was cast in as detective. Like, he was cast because of the cameo in Out of Sight. Keaton was cast as Detective Nicolette in Jackie Brown, and then Universal subsequently cast him for the cameo. So he was cast in Jackie Brown first.
And that is correct. We have live update from Tayo. Yeah. Thank you. According to Soderbergh's director's commentary of Out of Sight, he felt it natural to include the character, so he called Tarantino, who was still in post-production on Jackie Brown, and he allowed him to see all of Keaton's footage as Ray. So, dang, you are, I believe, 4 for 4. You're on it today, Cal.
Listen, I'm the only one with this movie on their list.
I was going to say, I mean, if you were going to get any, like, I guess this would be.
Yeah.
Okay, true or false?
Yeah.
A full Chicks Who Love Guns sales video was made for the film.
Absolutely true.
Yeah, and I love that it's true. Yeah. I'm so happy.
I cannot imagine he's like, I'm only going to shoot selects for this.
No. And you feel like he just did it for him.
Yeah, 100%.
He was like, this one's for me. Yeah. I need a gimme. while only brief glimpses of the video appear in the movie, the filmmaker shot a full 4-minute promo, which was later included in its entirety as a DVD extra.
Which
I have never seen, and now I really want to see.
It has to be a bonus feature.
It was directed by animator and graphics designer Norm Heaven. Sorry, probably mispronounced that. Who also co-wrote the script for the sequence with Tarantino.
Cool.
So.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, love that. That's true. Okay, you're on a roll. Let's see if we can keep it going.
How many more of these are there?
I don't, let's see. Just one.
Okay,
just
this one. Is the last one.
Last one. All right, let's see if you, that makes it high pressure. Yeah. You can make it or break it here. Jackie Brown drew praise from director Spike Lee, who championed the film in the press. This led to the start of a close friendship between Tarantino and Lee.
False.
I couldn't read that with a straight
face. That is very false.
I appreciate that one. No, Lee did not like it.
Yeah.
He criticized Tarantino for excessive use of the N-word, to which Tarantino countered, as a writer, I demand the right to say to write any character in the world that I want to write. Big controversy. Big old. Yeah.
Still a controversy to this day.
Still is. But wow. Good job, Cal. I mean, this is your movie.
Got them all.
Yeah. Got them all.
So.
Who
wins the movie?
I'll tell you who wins it for me.
So we
talked about this with In Bruges, and which we ended up giving to McDonough. And it's this kind of debate between, do you give it to the director because he drew a performance out of the actor?
This is all Pam Grier.
This is Pam Grier.
Yeah.
Like, not this time. Not Pam Grier.
This,
like,
is all Pam Grier.
Yeah. It is so inarguable to me. Yeah. Like, not that Quentin doesn't deserve a lot of credit, but, like, I genuinely can't think of anyone else.
Yeah. No, it's all Pam Grier.
It's all Pam Grier.
And kudos to Quentin, because there's, like, that anecdote floating around on the internet that, like coffee and all of her old movie posters were in his office, like, when she came to audition, and she thought he put them up to, like, make her feel more comfortable, but in reality he meant to take them down.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
That's funny.
But like talk about, like, a lull, right? Like, Pam was famous during the 70s, kind of disappeared for a little bit, and then just, like, popped up in the mid 90s to do this and just absolutely crushed it.
Yeah, and she was, like, she was Quentin's only choice, as she should have been.
Yeah, there's no one else that was doing this.
No one else. I cannot think of a single other person who could do it like she did it. No, this movie, I think, just does not work without Pam. Nope. I mean, shout out to everyone else, though. I mean, like we said, it's a great role for Samuel L. Jackson. And to be fair, I can't think of anyone else in that role besides him.
Yeah.
But it's just not as essential as a good Jackie Brown. And Pam Grier is a great one.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've talked about a lot. I think it's time for the reveal.
Wait, whoa.
Oh my God. I almost forgot your. Oh my God.
So who's Nicolas Cage being in this? Oh. I have two options for you.
Okay, give them to me.
Okay. Option number one, Lewis. A modern Nicolas Cage could probably be a modern or like 2010 to now Nicolas Cage could definitely be a good Lewis. Or Keaton.
I'm not mad about either of those. A lot of times I am mad about the Nicolas Cage picks.
I think if you had Nicolas Cage and Keaton combined, that would be too much and the Keaton character wouldn't have been able to stand out because they would have just been both too esoteric to have any one of them stand out. Because like, what's the other cop is good because he's just like a generic cop, which makes the eccentricities of Keaton really stand out and really juices the performance. Where if you had two guys being like weird,
yeah,
you know, they would have both seemed less weird.
That's true.
So he either is Keaton or he is, or we have an older Nicolas Cage as like the Lewis character.
So like, I'm not mad about those because as we just said, I can't think of anyone else as like Samuel L. Jackson, for example. I think like, not that they aren't great, Robert De Niro and Michael Keaton. I think you could find other actors for them.
I disagree. I think both of them are excellent.
Oh, no, they're both great. Yeah.
And I think like that is.
I don't think they're nearly as irreplaceable as Pam Grier or Samuel L. Jackson.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
But like that doesn't mean that this isn't actually a really, really good De Niro performance.
Oh, no, it's a great De Niro performance. I like Keaton, though. I think I could see Cage as the Keaton character for sure. The ATF agent.
Because like, I guess like what I'm trying to say is like, even this year, what year would. Copland, right?
Mm-hmm.
Two for two. So De Niro came out with both Copland and this in 1997. And like Copland also has him be a cameo, but like Copland is like a traditional De Niro cameo where he's like the cop and he's like, you know, eating the sandwich, like, you blew it. You know, like that is a very De Niro performance. And this film is equally good, like is it also a good movie, and this is just like a De Niro performance you don't really ever see.
Yeah,
and that's what I like about
I do really like De Niro on this, for the record. If I had to pick, Cage is Keaton. Just fun to say. All right, now we'll do the reveal. First of all, Cal, where is it on only your list?
It's on only my list, and it is number 69.
Nice. Yeah. I wonder what my 69 is. I really want to know. All right. So where does 69 on Woodford's list?
Where does 69 on Calibro's list get you?
I love that Tayo filled this with stuff to make it like a money bag.
There better be a beach towel in there.
Oh, now I want a beach towel. Oh no, it's money.
Oh, it's real money.
It's not real money. Marked? I think it's Monopoly money. Fake money. Can you imagine? I have to like sift through all the money. Oh, here it is. Okay. It is 207 on the not 100.
Right.
That makes sense. Because I remember because In Bruges was my 87 and it was 245, I think. So that makes sense. He put so much money in this.
The production value on this
show is crazy.
30 grand?
It's so good.
That is a $1,000 bill right here.
I can't imagine. This is all fake.
Go take this to the gas station, see if they can change
it. I mean, that's a pretty good $1,000 bill, I feel like. Wow, our production value here at Cinefix.
Through the roof.
Usually, I would reveal what we're talking about next time, but I think that might be up in there. Maybe there's surprises. Maybe Dan has us on our toes.
Who knows? He does.
We're always at the mercy of Dan.
Story of my life.
So with that, also last time I did not thank everyone, which was very rude of me. So thank you to producer Tayo Yankin, Jamie Parslow, he's just over there, Mariah Franzen, Clint Gage, who was not here today, but is here in spirit. And as always, absolutely no thank you to Nan. Like, come on.
It's a good close. And don't forget to stay tuned to the Cinefix podcast, wherever you listen to your podcast, or like, on YouTube, on the Cinefix YouTube channel.
We're a team effort here, really. Okay. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Nowadays, trends and news cycles change faster than we can blink. But there are some things that withstand the test of time. And if you're looking for a connection to something timeless, and maybe also a glimpse of life at a slower pace, I believe everyone can relate to the very human experiences explored in Jane Austen's novels. And that's where I come in. My name is Alison Larkin. I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin. I spent a lot of my childhood in the part of England where Jane Austen lived and wrote, and now that I live in the States, nothing gives me a sense of homecoming quite like narrating her books. On this show, you'll listen to award-winning narration. I'll give myself a pat on the back for that, as well as conversations with actors, writers, and other fascinating people who all share a passionate love for Jane Austen. So please join me as we embark on a wonderful journey through Jane Austen's work. Be sure to listen and subscribe to The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin, wherever you get your podcasts.